Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon around the valley. Look for a high of 105 and then a 20% chance for rain and blowing dust tonight with lows in the mid to upper 80s. Currently, it's mostly sunny and 104 degrees. Meanwhile, in valley traffic, an accident 101 northbound in Scottsdale is blocking the Shea Boulevard on-ramp. Also a collision to watch out for on the 60 westbound at Alma School. That's blocking the shoulder. Arizona's wildfire season has been busy, and while people want to get pictures of the blazes while they burn, KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports there are new efforts to keep people taking photos from above.
Most recently, crews fighting the Cedar Fire had to warn people not to fly drones and even threaten jail time for interfering with fire suppression efforts. Now the U.S. Department of the Interior has partnered with AirMap and Skyward to create real-time maps of fire lines. Christy Wiley with the Department of the Interior says their hope is to create a geofence, so when the virtual boundary is crossed, drone operators will be notified they've entered prohibited territory.
It increases tremendously the amount of information that's out to make those drone operators aware because, you know, we feel that, you know, responsible drone operators are not going to go out and purposely put the lives of aviators and firefighters in danger.
Right now, only the drone operators will be notified in real time. Wiley says they hope that same instant notification will soon get to first responders. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News.
One of Mexico's top drug lords has apologized to the U.S. government for the 1985 murder of a DEA agent, but denies having played a role in his death. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Monica Ortiz Uribe reports.
Rafael Caro Quintero apologizes on camera in an exclusive interview broadcast Monday by the Mexican news magazine Proceso. He led one of Mexico's first transnational drug cartels in the 1980s and is currently wanted by Mexican authorities. He was released from a Mexican prison in 2013 after serving 28 years for the murder of DEA agent Kiki Camarena.
Yo no quiero saber absolutamente nada con el...
Now Caro Quintero says his trafficking days are over and he wants to live in peace. A Mexican official recently accused Caro Quintero of wanting to take over a smuggling route across from the Texas border. The U.S. is currently offering a $5 million reward for information leading to his capture. Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News.
Following an intense 4 days in Cleveland for the Republican National Convention, attention today has turned to Philadelphia. That's where Democrats have gathered for their national convention, which will culminate on Thursday with the acceptance speech by presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. NPR's Don Gagne is in Philadelphia to give us a convention preview and update. Don, what are you seeing in the hall and on the streets of Philadelphia?
Already, it's been a little crazy, a little hectic, and there are stories breaking that the Democrats cannot be happy about. After the, you know, pretty successful rollout, it felt like, of Secretary Clinton's running mate, Tim Kaine, over the weekend, Senator Tim Kaine, suddenly the story that has taken over here in Philadelphia is that 20,000 emails that were leaked by WikiLeaks. We don't know what their original source was, but they're DNC emails. And because of what was in those emails, some evidence that the Democratic Party was not an impartial observer during the primaries. And there's some evidence that there was at least talk between staffers about ways to undermine the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. Well, the chairwoman, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, has stepped down effective this coming Friday. And today there have been kind of all kinds of protests and grumbling by Bernie Sanders supporters. And Sanders himself speaks tonight, and we're not sure what that's going to mean at the convention this evening.
A lot of that sounds very insidery. And yet at the same time, because a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters were not insiders, they may be more affected by this than other potential voters would be. Do you think that's a dark cloud that may stay over, or once the speeches start, that might go to the wayside?
It feels like the kind of story that disrupts things for a few days, but then kind of fades away as we get into the final 100 days or so of the campaign. But I can tell you, the Trump campaign is already milking it because it involves emails. Republicans are immediately linking it to the pre-existing email scandal involving Hillary Clinton and her private server. So the Republicans will try to keep this going and try to keep it as part of the narrative. The Democrats are hoping that by the time Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren speak tonight and Michelle Obama speaks tonight, and then the nominee, Hillary Clinton, speaks Thursday, that this will kind of be lost in the shuffle.
Now, Don, you've been traveling a lot, and that took you to Arizona late last week. You observed Senator John McCain. You also got a little bit of a vibe for what's going on. There's often talk, and this is no different during this particular election season, that maybe Arizona could turn to the Democrats in November. What did you pick up on based on the reporting you did?
Well, you see, Democrats are certainly energized and hoping that this might be the year where not only can they move toward Arizona turning blue in a presidential contest, but maybe they can push it over the edge. So there certainly is a lot of enthusiasm. They think one of the best things they have going for them to that end is the candidacy of Donald Trump itself. So there does seem to be a lot of work to both organize and to register Latino and Hispanic voters. So you can feel that buzz on the Democrat side. But when you talk to the Republicans, they say, you know, the Democrats always think they're going to flip Arizona, just like they think they're going to flip Texas and the like.
And Don, finally, coming out of this convention and what came out of the Republican National Convention, are you seeing, as someone who's been a reporter for a long time, are you seeing something different? Are we seeing this year as an odd convention year, frankly?
I'm seeing everything different this year. From the very beginnings of the primary season, I was in Iowa for the first time, you know, something like a year and a half ago, January of 2015 it was. At every turn, what has happened has confounded those of us who think we've built up some institutional knowledge so much so that we know what things mean and we know what could possibly be coming around the corner. I wouldn't predict what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone in a week. Or a month or in 100 days.
Don Gagne, NPR's national political correspondent. We've been lucky enough to catch up with him in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. And Don, thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Arizonans will be taking an active role in the Democratic National Convention. Congressman Raul Grijalva and Ruben Gallego have speaking roles, as does former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. And the state's delegates are getting excited about what they're going to hear and in supporting their nominee Hillary Clinton, even those who have been Bernie Sanders supporters. One of those is John V. Gomez. And John, what are your expectations as far as the theme of party unity?
I can definitely tell you that the party is going to Philly united. And here, especially here in Arizona, we're going to definitely be united because we feel that Arizona has a chance on being on the map. We have Anchor Patrick running for U.S. Senate against John McCain. We have a great chance of winning that. We have all the down-ballot races from the state legislature, school boards, you name it. And I think that this hateful rhetoric that the RNC, not only national but locally, are putting out there, I think that that's just dividing their party and helping us unite our party and get others involved in the Democratic Party in the process.
John, if Arizona is truly to be in play when it comes to November, as far as the presidential race is concerned, how important is the week of the convention? How important is it for that unity to not just be a word, but to really be seen in action, both at the Arizona level and then what people who are just seeing things on TV are going to be seeing from the general party?
Well, I think you see with the makeup of the DNC delegates, you'll see a wider range of backgrounds. You know, we have members from the Native American community, the African American community, the Hispanic community, the LGBT community, the veterans, elderly, the youth, you name it. If you were to see, if you looked on the floor of the convention last week, you primarily saw white upper to middle upper class individuals That's going to be different here. It's going to be a melting pot of what Arizona and our country represents.
John, you were in the primary season a Bernie Sanders supporter, right?
Yes.
So how do you feel at this point? How do you feel he was treated? Do you feel like moving forward? Because that was one of those things where people were wondering about party unity in general, because Bernie Sanders was considered to have sort of started a movement and gotten some great enthusiasm, some great support. And there was some concern with what happened during Arizona's presidential preference election, some of the mix-ups that happened that night. Do you feel at this point that things were fair, that Bernie Sanders got a good shot, and you're basically all in with Hillary Clinton?
You know, luckily for us who are Bernie delegates, the party, the National Party worked well with us and got most of what we were requesting, or the Sanders campaign was requesting. And that's issues like on education, LGBT issues, equality, you name it. I think that those issues that weren't that strong on the party platform, I think those individuals that represented Senator Sanders' campaign were able to get those messages on that platform. And I think we will have a stronger voice on the platform issues. And I think that having brought those issues to the platform will have those Bernie supporters come on board and support Hillary. I definitely plan on voting for Hillary when I'm down there.
John V. Gomez, one of Arizona's delegates to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. As NPR's Don Gagne referenced earlier in the show, Democratic National Committee Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz is on her way out, thanks at least in part to an email controversy that found her and others putting their support behind Hillary Clinton and criticizing Bernie Sanders. How did WikiLeaks get the DNC info? One theory posits it came from Russia, but is it just a conspiracy, and are they more prevalent these days? I'm joined by Al Tompkins of the Poynter Institute. Al, what do you make of the increase in conspiracy theories, especially related to politics and government?
It's an interesting one that conspiracies have kind of made a comeback. We haven't really seen conspiracies like this since, I don't know, maybe the Teapot Dome scandal or the Lindbergh baby or something. It's been a long time since we've had some really juicy conspiracies, but we've had quite a few of them recently. And I don't know that that I'm right about this, but it could be that one reason that conspiracies take off so fast is because they move so plausibly across the globe now and so quickly. And little pieces of information can be accurate, but still untrue. And so if there's any truth, people are certainly willing to go with the, well, where there's smoke, there's fire theory, which is not always true. Sometimes it's just smoke.
And one that people are really grabbing hold of is that there was a Russian hacking into
right.
the DNC, and so Vladimir Putin might be connected, and Donald Trump has said very nice things about Vladimir Putin. What do you make about this particular theory, Al? Are we getting on to something here?
Well, I have no idea. There is a correlation and causation thing, though, that we ought to talk about. Sometimes just because things are correlated doesn't mean that they're caused. For example, it turns out that that there are correlations, for example, between the divorce rate in Maine and the consumption of butter in the United States. It turns out that both of them move in almost exactly the same pattern. So what is the correlation and causation between these things? Look, I don't have any idea. And by the way, I don't think anybody else does either right now. I think one of the things to do is to play out, what if it was true? What would it matter? Would be a question that I would always pose.
It almost seems as though the way that the two respective parties' campaigns played out on both sides, it almost felt like they were playing into, hey, we don't really know what's going on in Washington. We're not really sure. And now
right.
that this DNC thing relates to maybe people at the DNC didn't really like Bernie Sanders.
But think about that. How surprising is it that people within the power structure at the DNC didn't like Bernie Sanders?
I mean, not at all.
Where's
right.
the surprise? I mean, there's no surprise there. Why is anybody surprised? And why is that such an issue that people within the power structure were saying, you know what, it'd be so much easier for us if we just didn't have such a contested race? I am not, maybe I'm the aberration here, I'm not in the least bit surprised by this. I get why that conversation would go on. Now, whether it should have inside, you know, a group that allegedly is not partial, but these are all political animals, and of course they're partial. I mean, who's surprised by that? I'm not.
Al Tompkins is a senior faculty member at the Poynter Institute. It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. Along with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. It's a global no-no. Republicans told us all last week that U.S. economic woes are due to bad trade deals.
America has lost nearly one-third of its manufacturing jobs since 1997, following the enactment of disastrous trade deals supported by Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Donald Trump cries woe and gloom while economic analysts around the world believe that, in fact, the U.S. economy is the bright spot in the world right now. The referendum on the safety of U.S. assets is a landslide in favor of the U.S., at least for now. Investments are pouring into the U.S., even if U.S. voters don't see it that way. What workers see in their economies and what governments see is the principal gauge of future prosperity, according to our next guest. Can workers make a living wage? How companies compete? If government and workers understand these to be priorities, then a bright future is possible. When workers and governments are completely at odds, as in Brazil, Turkey, and South Africa, rising stars can falter. Ruchir Sharma is head of emerging markets and chief global strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, and the author of The Rise and Fall of Nations, Forces of Change in the Post-Crisis World. Since the 2008 crash, he says, politics has become a wedge in the global economic system.
The longer a leader stays in office, the worse it is for a nation. And this is particularly true in developing countries where the institutions tend to be weak. So the leaders can have a big impact on that country. And this is my entire point in that chapter about Putin, about Erdogan. These are leaders that I have met and spent some time with. And it's the classic case that when they first came to office, they were very different. But by year 7, 8, and especially after a decade, they turn into very different creatures. And I think that's what's happened with Erdogan as well. When he first came to office, he was good for Turkey. He was carrying out a lot of economic reforms. And he has really slipped very badly now. And I think that currently I despair for what's happening in Turkey.
In reading this book, I looked back at the Brexit story and I thought to myself, you know, maybe this is all just smoke and mirrors. And that essentially what you describe in this book is that these relationships between Europe and Britain are unassailable. The underpinning relationship between Britain and the rest of Europe must go on.
Yeah, I think so, because I think that there's far too much for Britain to lose. But I think there's a bigger point about Brexit. Brexit is more effect than cause. And what do I mean by that? Every single thing we believed in about the world last decade has been turned on its head. And one of the very big trends, and I think Brexit is a manifestation of that, is that there's a massive anti-establishment wave running through the world today. So we track the popularity ratings of the leaders in the world's 20 largest democracies. They're down 20 percentage points. The fundamental cause here is that this is the weakest economic recovery in post-war history. And I think that that's what's really causing so much angst among voters across the world.
You describe a well-behaved billionaire in your attempt to chart success of an economy by looking at the success of individuals and leaders, corporate leaders, et cetera, in that country. What's a well-behaved billionaire?
Good billionaires are the ones which are respected by a country. If you create wealth in industries such as technology, manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, or stuff where the consumer at large feels that he or she is benefiting from this, those billionaires are well-respected. On the other hand, when you have wealth creation taking place by billionaires who are doing it through government connections, by gaming the system in industries which are prone to it, such as real estate, mining, or even oil and gas very often in large parts of the world, you end up getting a very negative reaction. And this is a point I make in the book, that if you look at the United States today, one redeeming quality I still find here is that no matter what we think of Trump, the fact that someone like Trump is being able to make a run for the top office despite being a billionaire, I think still tells you that wealth creation in this country is still sort of respected and not held against you. I travel to other countries, and from Russia to Mexico, there are so many bad billionaires or perceived to be bad that there's no way that they'd be able to make a run for the top office because the people just wouldn't stand for it.
What do you make of the economic discussion that's taking place in the U.S. election. America will be great again. We'll get these jobs back again. We'll change all these trade agreements. Is it talking nonsense? Does it have any basis in reality? Is the conversation, whether it's right or wrong, looking at a world the same way you see it?
Unfortunately not, because I think that what's really happened here is that a strength taken too far has become a weakness. So we had unfettered globalization for the last three decades. Obviously, not everyone benefited from it. So we seem to be stuck in this situation, which is that a backlash is taking place in the policy responses that we are taking towards those, which is to turn more inward, to sort of give up on free trade agreements, to close our borders much more to immigration. These are all likely to only worsen the situation.
Who scares you the most in terms of economic instability on a scale that could produce what we had in the crisis in 2008? Another example of that.
By far, China. This is a nation that I was in awe of growing up because of the incredible economic miracle that they produced for 30 years. But they really lost the plot after the global financial crisis in 2008-2009. They were keen to grow very rapidly in a much slower growth world, and they threw so much money and so much debt at the problem that since then they've not been able to sort of get back to normal. So if you look at the world today, this is really a G2 world, which is it's like about America and it's about China. These are the only two economies which can have global repercussions because of their size. And as far as China is concerned, the fact that it's become so addicted to debt that every time now they have even a minor economic slowdown, they just want to keep throwing more debt at the problem to somehow keep growth going is what scares me the most. Because when a nation takes on too much debt over a short span of time, I demonstrate that nation always runs into trouble in the next 5 years. And China, I think, is at that sort of point now.
Rishir Sharma is head of emerging markets and chief global strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. He's the author of The Rise and Fall of Nations, Forces of Change in the Post-Crisis World. Thanks so much.
Enjoyed being here. Thanks, Jim.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. It's often said that the first duty of any government is to protect its people, to provide security to its citizens. But what if there are clear limits to the protection that can be provided? When a French-Tunisian man drove a lorry into the crowd gathered in Nice, it was said afterwards that nothing could have stopped such a crime. It's led some to suggest that we'll just have to live with terrorist attacks, to accept them as part of modern life, as the BBC's Paul Moss reports.
There are signs all over the London Underground system right now, advising people to make sure they drink plenty of water during the current spate of hot weather. These sit rather oddly alongside other, more serious warnings about the threat from terrorism, unattended bags, suspicious behaviour. And speaking to passengers as they emerge into the daylight, it's clear that this latter threat is not one easily held in mind. Stoicism, the preferred attitude for many.
Do you think about terrorism when you're travelling?
No. If you thought about it, you wouldn't go anywhere.
How about you?
You just get on with it. If it happens, it happens. There's nothing much you can do about it.
You kind of have to put it out of your mind. If somebody has the intent to do something, I don't think you can stop it.
That's the sound of police trying to stop a terrorist attack. In the French city of Nice, armed officers fired repeated shots at the man who drove a lorry into a crowd of people. He managed to kill more than 80 before they eventually brought his spree to a halt. After the Nice attack, the French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, promised new measures to try and prevent a recurrence. But he also told his citizens they would have to live with terrorism. And he was echoed by one of France's senior senators, Nathalie Goulet, vice president of the Foreign Affairs Committee. She said simply, "We cannot prevent this." Such fatalism did not go down well. Mr. Valls was booed when he visited Nice. But his stance is supported by Professor Paul Rogers of Bradford University, the author of a new book on terrorism, Irregular Wars.
The nature of the modern urban industrial society is that it is always possible to find instruments, for example, a heavy truck, which can kill many people. So ISIS is losing more than 1,000 people a month, yet it is able to find ways of getting back at the countries concerned. It's going to become less and less possible for governments to ensure their citizens secure through the traditional means. And that has to be something which has to be recognised by politicians. It has to be recognised by the general public.
Our hearts go out to the French people and to all those who've lost loved ones or been injured.
Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May reacted to the Nice attacks by promising more could be done to tackle terrorism.
We must redouble our efforts to defeat these brutal murderers. The government is already making more funding available for the security services. It's also making more funding available for counter-terrorism policing.
Theresa May had only been in office for one day when Nice was attacked. The Guardian newspaper columnist Simon Jenkins has been in post rather longer and greets politicians' pledges of protection with a certain worldly weariness.
It's a characteristic of modern democratic leadership that people turn to those people they've elected and ask them to do something. It is a characteristic of those people who are so asked to say they will do something. There are things that politicians can do, like increase taxes and spend money. There are things they can't. One of the things they can't do is stop a man driving a truck into a crowd. I think an honest politician says, I can do this, but I can't do that.
But politicians will say, look, their job is to reassure people to look after the security of their country. It is simply politically impossible for any modern politician in a democracy to stand up and say, look, I'm awfully sorry about these terrorist attacks, but there's actually not much I can do. There's going to be more of them. No politician could say that.
Well, I can see when something terrible happens, people kind of go berserk and expect stupid things of stupid politicians. I just don't think it helps.
That's Simon Jenkins of the newspaper The Guardian talking to the BBC's Paul Moss. In KJZZ News at 2:35, the University of Arizona Cancer Center is contributing to a national effort to bring cancer treatments and prevention to patients within 5 years. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Sarah Hammond reports.
The U of A Cancer Center assembled researchers, clinicians, patients, and others from across the state to participate in Vice President Joe Biden's recent Cancer Moonshot Summit. The group offered several ideas to help meet the goal of completing a decade's worth of research in 5 years. Peter Lance is deputy director of the Cancer Center.
Some of the major areas that we could contribute included a very novel approach to diagnosing ovarian cancer.
Specifically, the U of A proposes to collect cells from a woman's fallopian tubes using a device developed for the screening. The cells would be measured against an abnormality score, the way a Pap test screens for cervical cancer.
Another area in which the U of A Cancer Center has great strength, in fact, is in imaging, that is radiology, various ways, many now non-invasively, ways to examine what is going on in a tumor.
Dr. Lance says the U of A Cancer Center is known for its expertise in cancer prevention programs and proposed ways to identify people who are obese, which increases their risk of developing cancer. I'm Sarah Hammond in Tucson.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Phil Latzman.
Now, Steve, 2016 will go down as a long, hot summer when it comes to policing and race relations.
The police shootings of unarmed black men in cities like Baton Rouge and St. Paul have sparked outrage in the African-American community.
And in turn, revenge killings of police in places like Baton Rouge and Dallas have sparked outrage among law enforcement.
But here in the Valley, where there have been protests, things have remained mostly peaceful when protesters and police have clashed in the streets of Phoenix.
Joining us now is Rashad Shabazz, who's an associate professor at ASU's School of Social Transformation. He's closely been watching events unfold in our community. So first of all, explain to us exactly what you do at ASU.
I look at how black geographies were created in the early part of the 20th century and how architecture and methods of confinement and policing were used to maintain those boundaries. And I look at the implications that they have. You know, by creating black geographies in the early 20th century, those geographies that still stand to this day in cities like Los Angeles and Oakland and Chicago and New York, those geographies have become places that are heavily policed. Many of them are impoverished, many of them lack resources. And the role of policing in maintaining boundaries and what that has done to the population, how it spiked things like arrest rates and how it spiked things like incarceration rates, and how it's also created a tension between black communities and police.
Here in Arizona, we don't have the black community and population that we would have in many big cities around the country. But we do have what I guess is sort of loosely defined as a Black Lives Matter movement. In your area of research and kind of studying these things, is there a legitimate movement here in Arizona for supporters of Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, Black Lives Matter Arizona, from what I know, is very active. I met some of the activists about a year ago, and I've participated in some of the events over the past 2 weeks. And Black Lives Matter is doing really important work here. And I think Black Lives Matter particularly is being also attentive to the struggle for immigrant rights, right, which is something that is really germane to Arizona. You know, it really speaks to our political landscape here.
In your opinion, in the protests and the rallies that we've seen here in the Valley over the past few weeks, how has that been handled?
The point of doing demonstrations is to disrupt. Like, that's the point. The killing of unarmed Black men and women is no longer acceptable. So what's happening here in terms of those protests is that they are well attended. They represent what I think is the future of the Valley, which is younger people, multiracial people. You know, there were Blacks, there were Latinos, there were whites. It was really, you know, New Phoenix, if you will. And there's a vision being expressed. What does need to happen is that energy needs to be bottled up into organized political engagement.
You add in the racial profiling on Latinos that Maricopa County Sheriff's Office is accused of carrying out. Does that sort of bond the Black community and the Latino community in a way that perhaps other communities aren't bonded?
I think it does. You know, Black Lives Matter has, and I think is, trying to create inroads to bring in, you know, not only whites who are sympathetic, but also other people of color who face very similar circumstances, and Latinos, both in the state of Illinois, in New York, and obviously here, face it. You know, the signifier or the face of criminality in Maricopa County and in Arizona is brown, right? You know, Mexico has been seen as a boogeyman in a lot of ways. So I think it's important that Black Lives Matter activists and those who are thinking about criminal justice really be attentive to what that means to Latino communities and try to really understand that there is this relationship between how immigration works in the United States, what that means in Maricopa County, and how to organize a broad-based political movement here in Maricopa County that addresses the lives and realities of migrants, particularly Latinos.
Rashad Shabazz is an associate professor at ASU's School of Social Transformation. Hey, thanks very much for being here and your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The city of Prescott has become a national destination for the drug rehab industry. In recent years, the number of group homes for recovering addicts has risen dramatically, at one point to more than 200, and that's caused substantial issues both for the community and those in recovery. But thanks to a new state law that takes effect the beginning of next month, the city can now begin regulating these homes much more closely. Prescott will be holding a public hearing this week about the possible new rules, and KJZZ's Will Stone, who's been reporting on this issue, joins me now. Will, first of all, let's define what these group homes really are.
Steve, group homes, also known as structured sober living homes under the new law, are essentially homes where you may have half a dozen or so people who are in recovery for drug or alcohol addiction living together in a sober, clean environment. And often these people will spend their days either out working or oftentimes at meetings or in outpatient treatment. So it's thought of as part of the spectrum of care, where it's not as intensive as an inpatient program might be, and it's not as expensive either, but it provides a structured setting for people who are still working on their recovery to live in. And one model that has really flourished in Prescott is the so-called Florida model, which is when you have these group homes closely affiliated with certain outpatient programs. There'll be three or four homes, and all the residents of those homes will go to the same outpatient program during the day. And that has really, Prescott has become somewhat of an unlikely national destination for these kind of recovery programs.
Well, let's dig in a little bit more deeply about when you become a national destination, that's going to create some new problems. What sort of problems are there?
What has happened is at one point, you know, upwards of 200 of these group homes had been counted in Prescott, many of them clustered in the historic downtown area. So you'd have streets where just home after home may all be for group homes. And there were kind of two areas of issues. The first is community problems. Neighbors felt like the character of their neighborhood was changing. There were issues with just loud noise. And then also more serious concerns about crime and criminal activity. Obviously, a lot of people in recovery, unfortunately, relapse. And so we have looked at the numbers, and there does seem to have been an increase in drug arrests in the last couple of years as we've seen a rise in these homes. Then the second issue is really the quality of care within these homes. Because they are largely unregulated by the government, they don't have to be licensed. You hear stories about people overdosing in the homes, people getting kicked out of homes onto the street when they ran out of insurance care. That is kind of another area that has been focused on. How do we protect the patients who, after all, are, you know, need good quality health care?
Well, earlier we referred to a new state law. Why was it passed and what will it do?
It allows local cities and governments to bring more oversight of these homes. They can't go in, they can't do everything, but now they can at least require permits, more information about, you know, who runs these homes, making sure the supervisors within the homes have certain qualifications, as well as they have been sober for a certain period of time themselves. And it's all in an effort to essentially reduce some of the neighborhood community issues, but also to make sure that people recovering from addiction are don't end up on the street if they mess up once.
So there are, though, some concerns about the new law. What are some of those?
You know, a big issue has to do with federal law. People who are recovering from addiction are considered a protected class. They're considered handicapped under federal law. And that means you can't discriminate against them. So you have to make sure that the city is passing these laws in a way that ensures their safety, but also isn't viewed as discriminatory. Prescott really has a balancing act where they need to work with the industry, come up with regulations that will ensure safety, but also avoid lawsuits. And that's what they'll be working on the next couple months.
KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
It's Monday, so let's celebrate the working life. We're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. Maybe you need to get to the Diamondbacks game, or you're meeting a friend for lunch downtown. Many people in the city use the light rail to get around. On average, there are 17 two-car trains rolling on the line, and they speed along at 35 miles an hour. Today, we step into a day on the job driving a light rail train.
My name is Sam Haddad, and I'm a train operator for Valley Metro. With this shift, I come in at 3:10, and I get off at 12:30. It doesn't look much, but there's a lot of people that go in here. I mean, there's 66 seating. And that's besides standing that they come in here. Usually, our train is pretty packed. Right here, this is our joystick. To get it into gear, you have to press down and then go back. And that accelerates. And then to brake, it's forward to brake in it. Because we have both sides to drive. You could drive from that end and this end. So if we ever have to go back, we actually go to the other end to go in reverse. On a normal day, if we moved, we would close the doors. Everybody gets in, and we always have to acknowledge that, you know, that we're moving. We usually press two bells. The louder one is in case they don't get our acknowledgement, not many people can hear us, and this is the horn. But our biggest concern is the safety of the people. Nothing in this train is automated, except for the announcements.
Approaching station, 24th Street and Jefferson.
And sometimes we actually make the announcements too. Like for instance, stand clear of the doors, or when we're coming at the end of the night, every platform we have to tell them that 44th Street would be the last stop for this train. First stop, you probably pick up at least 60 people. On events, we usually drive three-car trains, like, you know, ASU games and football games. We could pick up 600 people altogether.
Approaching station. 38th Street.
Everybody needs transportation. Not everybody's unfortunate to have a car. So it's nice, you know, to have transportation. I love driving train. I always wanted to drive a train.
That's Sam Haddad operating a train through the valley. Route 66's history is one that's primarily connected with the Nat King Cole song about getting your kicks and the fun, quirky shops and storefronts along the 2,500-mile road that covered 8 states. But that route was often an uncomfortable, sometimes risky one for African-American travelers. One small way to quell that risk was what was called the Negro Motorist Green Book. It let African-Americans on the road know which restaurants they could eat in and which hotels they could stay in. Historian and scholar Candace Taylor has been researching the book's history for her Green Book project, in which she documents the properties in the Green Book, and she joins me now. Candace, what was it like in the 1930s when the Green Book first came out?
It was an intense time when Route 66 started, and most Black people didn't travel at all, you know, because it was simply too dangerous. So it wasn't until 1936 that Victor Green developed his travel guide, which was dubbed as the Green Book. At the time it was published, it was called the Negro Motorist Green Book, specifically to deal with the issue of Black travel in America, because at that time also there were approximately about 10,000 sundown towns. They were towns that were all white on purpose. Basically, you know, places where if you were driving through and the sun went down and you were Black, your life was in danger. So some of these towns would have signs, or there would be a bell that would chime at 6 p.m. And for people who knew that area, who were around there, knew that if you were Black, that was your cue to leave. And so this Green Book was such a godsave. It was really a national guide, but plenty of people who were driving Route 66, especially if they were Black, would use the Green Book because it had a huge level of resources. I mean, everything from restaurants to tailors, anything you might need on the road, beauty shops, barber shops, taverns, gas stations, churches, all kinds of places that were safe zones for Black people.
And was this widely known about? Was it something that had to get sort of a word of mouth and then more people knew about it?
Well, it was definitely word of mouth in the beginning. And Victor Green created the guide. He was inspired by the Jewish traveler guides that were published in the 30s that were serving the Borscht Belt in northern New York. And, you know, he was a postal worker living in Harlem, and that's how he started, you know, when he started this guide, he had this other network of postal workers, because it was a union job, throughout the country, and they would help promote the Green Book on their route. But another major factor was Exxon, which was Standard Oil, Esso gas stations during that time, were major distributors of the Green Book. And by the 60s, we estimate that, you know, over 2 million copies were sold.
Is there anything to indicate those who were listed in the Green Book faced any backlash for being at least somewhat welcoming to Black people?
You know, it took courage to be a Green Book site. And I'm definitely very interested in the business owners who chose to advertise in the Green Book. Whether it was the majority, we do know, were Black business owners, and the majority of Green Book sites are clustered in what were traditionally African-American neighborhoods. There were, in addition, also others that were, you know, in unusual places that you wouldn't think would be listed in the Green Book. And there was definitely backlash. I mean, we've read stories of, you know, a place where, you know, the hotel that wasn't listed in the Green Book, but there was a hotel where, you know, these light-skinned Black people went to in Arizona. They said, well, you know, we'll let you stay. If anybody asks, you have to say that you're Mexican. There was no way for people to really get a, you know, plan ahead too far in advance, particularly on Route 66. You know, we know that half the counties along Route 66 were sundown towns. So about 44 out of 89 counties along Route 66 were sundown towns. So that means, you know, not only do you need this guide, you need to make sure that as you time your travel that you're not going to end up anywhere near a sundown town after 6 p.m. Because even driving through was life-threatening.
Historian and scholar Candace Taylor. We've been talking about her Green Book project, which in part documents where African Americans could safely travel along Route 66. Phoenix is undergoing some dramatic changes, many of them centered around the downtown area, as more people of all ages have decided to come back from the suburbs and settle in the city center. But there's still work to be done to make the city more walkable and bikeable and more of a community. The group This Could Be Phoenix got started with a lot of those concepts in mind, and it also recently got involved with the National This Place Matters campaign, which was introduced by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. I met in downtown with Quinn Wisson, co-founder of This Could Be Phoenix. We made a point of being inside, thanks to the triple-digit temperatures. I started by asking Quinn what drove her to come back to her hometown. Had she changed, or had the city?
I think the answer to that would be both. I think I changed in sense of, you know, I traveled a lot. So I saw cities around the world and country and what made cities great and what made cities not so great. And I lived in LA for a long time, which I would probably put in the not so great bucket in terms of driving and how much you have to be in your car. So when I came back to Phoenix, I noticed the light rail had happened while I was gone. And that really changed the whole landscape of the area, from bringing ASU downtown to people actually living here again. And so my perspective changed of just, you know, this isn't a place that's unsafe anymore that I don't want to come to or only want to go to a Suns game. It's actually a place I can live, work, and play and have a relatively vibrant urban life too. So a little bit of both.
Quinn, why do you think there has been a change? I mean, is it about, because we've heard about transplants coming from other places with different attitudes of things, and many of them end up throwing up their hands and moving to Portland, for example. Why do you think that's not going to happen this time?
I think it actually reflects a larger trend, not just nationally, but globally, of having people move back to the city centers. I think if we look back to the 50s, 60s, maybe even before that, to just after the Second World War, we see that white flight, that suburban race out to have land and space. And it's actually kind of reversing now, where people want to come back in the city. And you're finding that really globally because it's more sustainable, first off, in terms of climate change and just the changes that we're having with population growth. But I think people are also really, you know, they're yearning for connection and not having to be in their car moving from place A to place B and actually being able to be part of a community. And you seem to find that a lot more in urban centers where people are more densely gathered. So I think it honestly, what's happening in Phoenix reflects a larger shift in mindset of really humankind. And so it's just up to a lot of us, you know, kind of early adopters, I guess you could say, but we're not even the earliest. There have been people working on this for years to say, hey, Phoenix is a viable city. Come back if you can. Remember, it's about sustainability. But it's, obviously, it's an upward battle to change perceptions that have been here for so long, even with someone like me who grew up here.
So this could be Phoenix. Could be Phoenix. Should be Phoenix. When we think about could be, what are some things that come to mind for you as far as what examples Phoenix could follow or what examples you've already sort of started putting into place?
So yeah, we picked could be, since should be was a little assertive. Could be is full of potential. So I think we've looked to a lot of other cities that maybe have been considered B cities or C cities in a sense, where, you know, A cities are New York, LA, B cities might be Seattle, Portland. But then there's some C cities that are coming up, like Austin probably used to be a C city. We've got Cleveland, Cincinnati, even Detroit could be considered at this point in its history a C city. And so looking at what's happening in those areas? How are grassroots organizations revitalizing by engaging the community, but also navigating the civic participation system in a very smart way? So I think it's combining that community engagement with savvy civic, you know, kind of activity, and then figuring out how you can gather support around a common goal to reach what you're going for.
Let's think about the definition of this place matters. How much of that has to do with what came before it and how much is what it could be going forward? I mean, as opposed to, you know, we talk about preservation, but also how much of the spirit of a place, if there is such a thing, do you want to preserve or does one want to preserve when it comes to this place mattering? I mean, can there be an evolution from that?
I think the spirit of the place is essential when you're talking about what places matter, and that spirit of a place tends to come out more fully when you have a historic building or an older building. I mean, we have to be careful about historic because in Phoenix, anything is considered historic, you know, after the 60s or before the 60s. But I think it's places that matter that have a full narrative. You know, there's bars here like Valley Bar, and you can tell a story of what that used to be, or Melinda's Alley. And I think when there's a story attached to a place, that makes it matter even more because you can have that emotional connection and you don't feel like it's just this cookie cutter place that someone just built to, you know, grab money. Like, yeah, I had a business perspective in the beginning, but I think more and more people in urban settings, especially in Phoenix where we've torn down so many buildings, places that matter have potential, but they also have a background.
Quinn Wisson is co-founder of This Could Be Phoenix. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.